Thank you. Thank you to organizers to bringing me to this wonderful place. And I should talk today about light actinides, and I just tentatively made three blocks. The first one will be general introduction, and then two examples from my own research activities. One will be on one of the numerous uranium compounds, the one which is very close to the onset of magnetism and shows some anomalous properties, namely the non-Fermi liquid behavior and also the band metamagnetism. And the third part will be dedicated to plutonium, which we already started here in the discussion. I was not really sure what will be interesting for you, so if you feel that something is too trivial or boring, just tell me and we will skip it and we will go to something else. Huh? It's actually more than half century ago that people realized that actinides, the elements behind the radon, are those which are gradually filling the 5F electron shell and not the 6D shell as was originally assumed. So this makes them direct counterparts to the lanthanides, which are gradually filling the 4F shell, although as you might see on the chart, the atomic configurations are slightly different between corresponding lanthanide and actinide, for example here for thorium and cerium. But the differences are not so important that we should stress them at the first approximation. The difference is mainly in the spatial extent of the particular electron shells. You know that in lanthanides the 4F states are very deep in the core of atoms, so the overlap of the wave functions between nearest neighbors is practically negligible, and it's actually the atomic physics which describes them pretty well, including magnetism, which is given by Hund's rules. The 5F states must be larger in extent because they must be orthogonal to the 4F states, and then it makes them a little bit more towards the 3D states, where we see something typically like narrow band behavior. So the overlap of the particular wave functions between nearest neighbors starts to be important. If we organize elements according to the ascending spatial extent, we see that magnetism, which means magnetic ordering, typically appears for these 4F, 5F, and late 3D states, whereas then we get the D band already so broad that we are ending up at typical Pauli paramagnetic behavior. The role of the 5F states in individual actinides can be very well seen from this view graph, the upper one, where we see the Wigner sites radius depending on the element number. And the 5D states and 4D and 3D are very, very similar. They just follow the parabolic dependence, which reflects that the states which are just filled are participating to the bonding. So we get filling of the bonding states, and at the end of the series, we get filling of the antibonding states. So then again, the volume a little bit increases. For the rare earth, except for some anomalous ones, we see in this scale practically independent size of atoms, which is reflecting the fact that the 4F states are not participating in the bonding. Actinides, which are red, they show something like hybrid behavior. At the beginning of the series, we see that up to plutonium, we see probably participation in the bonding. And then we have a large step to americium and something which is resembling the rare earth. So we can already from that deduce that we have localized 5F states behind americium. For plutonium, we have six allotropes, and this is alpha, and this is the largest one, delta. So with delta, we are already probably somewhere halfway towards the localization. And you know that the localization, delocalization, transition. This is probably one of the baselines also of this workshop. This is something which is interesting, and we would like to see it in more details. And unfortunately, this step is too large, so we cannot see the details between pure elements. And I will come to that point later. The other characteristic feature is that if we are getting to this critical situation where we approach the localization, which happens for americium, we are getting less and less symmetric crystal structures. Also, the melting point is very much suppressed. And this fact that we see more and more structures and they are less and less symmetric, this can be in a hand-waving way understood as due to sort of electronic Jahn-Teller effect, that we have narrow band and high density of states at the Fermi level.
Just a question about this phase diagram. When you draw a phase in between two elements, these are alloys between the two?
Yeah, these are alloys. Yeah. Uh-huh. This is actually pretty well studied since decades ago.
So, for example, there are
plutonium
americium alloys.
Yeah.
They make nice solid solutions all over the range.
Yes. More or less. I mean, you can get 60% americium into delta plutonium, still keeping the FCC structure.
So this sort of delocalization transition, when going from localization transition from plutonium to americium, can be seen as you vary the relative concentration of plutonium and americium.
You could see it, but you see localized americium, and then you can see still delocalized plutonium, and this is one of subjects to which I will come at the end of my talk. You will see. So I wanted to say that if the system has a high density of states at the Fermi level due to narrowing of the band, it can decrease the total energy either going magnetic. This is one way if the Coulomb interactions are strongly enough. But there is also other way if the Coulomb interactions are not so strong. It might be preferable that the system just changes the structure towards less symmetric. So we have to invest some Madelung energy, but we are in this way reducing some part of the high density of states from the Fermi level towards higher binding energies and reducing thus the total energy. It's interesting to see then what is the development of the basic bulk properties. Especially, I selected here the gamma coefficient of the low temperature specific heat. So this is the electronic term. C is proportional to gamma T, and gamma should reflect the electron density at the Fermi level or quasi-particle density of the Fermi level. And similar quantity is chi zero. These characterize those elements quite well because all of them up to americium are Pauli paramagnets. So there is nothing like Curie-Weiss behavior, no sign of magnetism, and we are just gradually increasing gamma and similar chi zero. I said that americium is localized already, but it is in the 5F6 configuration where the spin and orbital moments compensate. So we end up at J equals zero, so it is also non-magnetic. And then we make this very large step up to curium, berkelium, californium, and so on, where we have large effective moments and Curie-Weiss behavior and magnetic ordering, and this is actually analogous to rare earth, and there is nothing really very, very interesting. So this is the two points which we would like to bridge somehow to see the details. One way now, for example, is to put high pressure, and I bring back this phase diagram that if we apply very high pressure to americium, we end up at some of these low symmetry structures of plutonium. This is very recent experiment done by Steve Heathman in the diamond anvil cell. We can't see the development of magnetic properties, but we can see the change of the crystal structure.
But it looks like Wilson ratio is very different, you know, for light actinides.
Yeah. I mean, they are. I said that they are Pauli paramagnets because the susceptibility is temperature independent. But of course, there is large enhancement because these values are very very high for pure elements. So these values are very high. So there is some renormalization. And as to the ground state, this gamma is the highest for all pure elements of periodic table, and the world record has delta plutonium. This is the one with the highest volume, which is about 50 millijoules per mole Kelvin square. So this shows that there is already something very, very anomalous going on, and it is more or less strange that we don't see any sign of magnetism, at least on magnetic susceptibility. We see actually something on electrical resistivity, and there is also very systematic development from simple behavior for thorium, protactinium, uranium. Then we have already large increase and tendency to saturation for neptunium and even negative slope for alpha plutonium. So this tells us that there might be something like fluctuating magnetic moments with 100 K as something like characteristic temperature.
There is no phase transition there?
No, not at all. Susceptibility is just temperature independent. And curium, this is already magnetically ordered, and this is the Knell temperature, 52 Kelvin.
Plutonium looks very much like mixed or Hertzian material.
Oh yeah.
No, because there's no curie by susceptibility.
From resistivity.
Yes, but magnetism.
Right.
It reaches already anomalously high values for pure element because 200 microohm centimeters is usually assumed as sort of maximum metallic resistivity.
What is Wilson ratio for this one?
I don't know. It's I don't know the values, but let's come to here. Let's assume that thorium is it's rather normal, so we have enhancement by the factor of 5 in gamma for plutonium, and this is also about factor of 5. So then this should be still normal. Yeah. Yeah. So we can't really see the details of the localization with pure elements, but of course we can do compounds. And if we have a compound, we naturally separate more and more the actinide ingredient, which is leading to the narrowing and localization, depending on the contents of the actinide element. But we also get into the game the hybridization with the states of the non-actinide ligand, so we have another degrees of freedom. And for each of the light actinide elements, we have sort of characteristic spacing, after which, if the spacing is larger, we can get magnetic ordering because we have already enough localization. If we are far below, we usually get superconducting ground state, although the superconducting characteristic temperatures are pretty low. This is sort of maximum 3.7 for uranium 6 iron, I think. Then we get for uranium, this spacing is about 350 picometers. It's called Hill limit. And if we get to this area, we get typically ferromagnets, which have appreciable ordering temperatures, still mostly below the room temperature, but not on the Kelvin scale, but typically 100 Kelvin. If we proceed even further, we get more probably antiferromagnet. Ordering temperatures are reduced again because the active atoms are already far and far from each other. And at the end, we get whole bunch of anomalous compounds like heavy fermions, uranium, beryllium 13, which is strong spin fluctuator with non-conventional superconductivity. We have compounds which have very low ordered magnetic moments, with very high gamma, which means heavy fermions, uranium, copper 5, U2, zinc 17, we get compounds where superconductivity, non-conventional again, and antiferromagnetism coexists, uranium, palladium 2, aluminum 3, and even recently discovered one where superconductivity and ferromagnetic ordering coexist. This is uranium, rhodium, germanium. How does the, superconductivity, this is one of the exotic many body features, but we are interested about how the underlying electronic structure looks like depending on the components, because we would like to be able to tune the system somehow. We have a whole bunch of binary compounds, but it's actually easier to study the ternary ones because they crystallize in several typical crystal structures where we have many members of the family, and we have a large degrees of freedom to tune the hybridization with the non-transition and especially with the transition element. And here I'm showing results of band structure calculations for some isostructural compounds. This is just by accident, this anomalous uranium, rhodium, germanium. And these are results of my colleague Martin Divish from Prague, but I should mention that the person who contributed substantially already more than 20 years ago to calculations of actinides is Mike Brooks, who brought up several concepts like large orbital moment, which was first calculated and only then it was confirmed by experiment. This is titanium nickel silicon orthorhombic crystal structure, and I should say that all light actinides are, from chemical point of view, strongly electropositive elements. Physicists would say that they have low work functions. So the 5F states are rather close to the zero energy. And then if we make a compound with transition metals, it depends if we take the metal from the left part of periodic table, which also has low electron negativity, so they are also electropositive, and then these states fit to about the same energy as the 5F states. And if we proceed to the right end, we increase electronegativity, and the D states are pushed more towards higher binding energy. So the overlap in energy with the 5F states is reduced. The hybridization DF is reduced. The bandwidth of the 5F states is reduced, and we typically produce magnetically ordered compound in compounds where transition metals are from the very last column of the periodic table, or even the field like copper, gold, silver. So let's look, for example, at the example of uranium, cobalt, germanium, and nickel, germanium. You can see that for nickel we have a little bit shift of this feature, which contains mainly the 3D states of nickel, towards high binding energies. And we have already appreciable density of states at the Fermi level, and therefore we get magnetic ordering even predicted from the Stoner model. The Stoner criterion is fulfilled. Whereas for cobalt, we have these guys are shifted a little bit towards the Fermi level, and we are just missing this high density of states. The Fermi level is below. Uranium, cobalt, germanium is non-magnetic. We get even less magnetic features when we put iron inside, which is contradicting to normal situation in transition metal systems, where if we introduce iron, we usually support magnetism, magnetic ordering. Here it is just negative. The iron 3D states are moving more towards the Fermi level, and Fermi energy is located somewhere in the minimum between 3D and 5F states, which are strongly hybridized. You can see that there is also, due to spin orbit splitting, we have two 5F subbands, 5F 5½, 5F 7½, and you see nearly no splitting for iron. And we see actually some spin orbit splitting if we go to heavy transition metals like platinum. So this D band is rather broad, which is due to the splitting of the 1/2 and 3/2 subbands. So spin orbit splitting. This is LDA calculation. LDA calculation gives more or less correctly the onset of magnetism, where the Stoner criterion is fulfilled. It gives more or less proper atomic volume. Of course, it can be improved by the GGA. I said that a significant contribution was performed by Mike Brooks, and one of them is the existence of the large orbital moment. You know that for lanthanides, you have the orbital moment, the atomic orbital moment given by the Hund's rules, and you have practically no orbital moment in standard itinerant magnetic systems like the 3D metals, because the spin orbit interaction is weak comparing to the bandwidth. So if you sort the states by individual ML values, you don't get very much difference in occupation. So you have orbital moments on the level of 0.01 Bohr magneton, typically for iron, cobalt, nickel. Doesn't go over 0.1 Bohr magneton. Here we are in different situation. We have a heavy element, and the spin orbit interaction starts to be significant, and we are inducing very large orbital moments, even in systems which are itinerant. The orbital moment can be even larger than the spin moment, which is the one which induces it. So we are the simple idea that we have essentially the magnetic ordering is driven by spin interactions, and then we induce orbital moment. Here you see this line represents the value of orbital moment or the ratio mu L over mu S, which we would expect on the basis on the Hund's rules. And we are for...
Just thinking of the atom when you mean Hund's
rule? Atomic Hund's rules. And for systems which are still magnetically ordered but go to very, very weak ferromagnetism like uranium nickel too, we have a suppression of the orbital moment from the free ion value to about the same size of the spin moment. And they are, because we are less than half filter, they are antiparallel oriented, so they nearly cancel each other. So we can have a spin moment, orbital moment, and the compound is practically non-magnetic. The remaining moment is on the level of 0.01 Bohr magneton, the J. This can be somehow understood by the fact that the orbital moment should be somehow more sensitive to the delocalization. The orbital moment density is located if one does the calculation, and probably Mike would tell the same, that the orbital moment density is located deeper in the core of the atom than the spin density, so it is more sensitive to the delocalization. So if we start to delocalize, we are first losing mainly the orbital moment and only then the spin moment. At least this is very, very rough idea, and it's still questionable if it is the case. We don't have really systematic evidence about many compounds what is the spin and orbital moment, because experiments are quite difficult. You need a polarized neutron experiment on a good single crystal, or you need the dichroism, which can give precisely at least the orbital moment. And there is still some experimental uncertainty, especially for systems where the moments are small, so the magnetic scattering is weak.
But on the level of atom, can you tell us what is actually the situation? Is it a scattering of Fermi's regime or JJ?
At least for plutonium, JJ coupling gives better results, but as far as I know, the ground state for LS coupling and JJ coupling is not very different. Then the excited states are more different, but we get about a similar ground state moment. Probably you will agree, yeah?
So there has been no neutron scattering to try to get the form factors to separate orbit from spin?
There were on let's say 15 compounds or 20 compounds.
And in those compounds, it's true that the orbital moment is more delocalized than the spin moment?
Yeah.
The other way around?
We have.
So which one is more localized?
J, the L is more inside. Huh? You have the
if
form factor.
How do you lose it when you become itinerant?
You lose L. You lose more of L, and S is remaining.
But why? If L is inside the core, why would you lose it? You would expect the thing which is outside the core to be lost first.
No, you are bringing electrons out of the core. So if L should be inside the core, you are losing L. This is, at least for me, logical. But I don't have really strong arguments.
I think the shape of the magnetization density from orbital currents is such that the scattering field, the field that scatters the neutrons, is more towards the center of the atom, the orbital position for the spin. That's why you can get the total of the cancer, you still get scattered. So that's one side of the story. But the other side of the story is that when you, if you put something under pressure or you broaden the bands, this quenches the orbital moment rather more rapidly than it quenches the spin moment. That's something different.
But in fact, pure uranium, we can still study induced magnetic moment induced by magnetic field, and it seems that even in such system there is a sizable orbital moment. So this systematics is sort of questionable, and we have to do more and more experiments on different types of compounds.
One very powerful method to study separately.
It was applied, and for some of them, and you can get a good result assuming some rules for L. The results for S, where you have to go to Compton scattering, is much less clear, and then there is some disagreement.
To confirm that L is very large.
Yeah. There is disagreement by 10-15% comparing to the neutrons, but L is definitely large.
And there are also separate tests with measurements, is that for those compounds when we measure L and S separately to be the same, then of course you should see compensation if you just do normal magnetization measurements.
Oh yeah, you see that the bulk moment is very small, and then you see the form factor which has a maximum and then goes to zero for uranium iron 2 or uranium nickel 2. So this is a matter of fact, and the existence of orbital moment has severe consequences. For example, on magneto-optical data, you have a tendency to very strong Kerr rotation, and this is something very very important. The strong spin orbit coupling is affecting also strongly the symmetry of magnetism, what is the easy magnetization direction and hard magnetization direction. Because if you assume, let's take one plane of uranium atoms, we don't bother what is in between, they are bonding, and you have, because you have about 3 electrons per atom, they occupy preferentially the states which are pointing to the nearest neighbor. So we have a sort of two-dimensional system of bonding 5F states, which means that we occupy the states which have orbital moment perpendicular to the plane. We have also spin moment perpendicular to the plane, which is kept by the spin-orbit interaction. So we have typically material which should have easy magnetization direction. So to turn the moments into the plane is impossible. This is simple model, but it introduces in fact absolutely new type of magnetic anisotropy, because the strong magnetic anisotropy found in rare earth materials is single ion anisotropy, where the anisotropy is given by crystal field phenomena, which means interaction of lanthanide with environment, the spin density or electron density, charge density, just in the environment of the rare earth atom. Here, what is important is the direction towards the nearest uranium neighbor.
And
basically geostabilization is different from different directions. I mean, this is Coulomb crystal.
Oh, yeah.
It's essentially for stabilization, which with dielectrics on the other side. And you speak also about directional stabilization. Where is this physical difference between?
The difference is that here really doesn't matter which types of atoms or which electron density we have in between. For the same type of coordination, we have always the same type of anisotropy. For example, we have the compounds, sort of layered compounds, where uranium atoms are in layers. I will show them in 5 minutes. And the difference between layers is larger than the uranium spacing within the layer. So then moments are always perpendicular to the layer, irrespective of all other constituents of the compound. Similarly, if we have arrangement in some linear chains, we have always something like easy plane anisotropy, where moments can be perpendicular to this preferential axis, and it is impossible to move them into. The strength of this anisotropy is in fact comparable to the bonding energy, because if we tried really to move the moments out of this easy magnetization direction, we would have to apply energy which would comparable to decoupling of these F states from the bonding, or we would have to break the spin orbit interaction, and they are very, very high. So we are suddenly on the level of electron volts, which is enormous.
Logically, there are only two types of anisotropy. One of them, which is single site, and another is exchange anisotropy, which is just anisotropic exchange J parallel with ISJ, for instance, is different from J perpendicular. So this term is a single site still. If it's a single site, then I agree with it. No matter of principle between.
I don't know if you can still call it a single site, because
if you just try to describe it by a certain term from Newtonian, would it be single site term or would it be exchange term coupling two neighboring sites? I think
another question. Well, if I understand correctly, the main point about this compound being different from rare earths is that here this anisotropy is formed by F bonding.
Yeah.
Not by FT.
Yeah.
Like in rare earth. So in other words, it's also crystal field, also single site, but the point is that it's much more directional because it's made by FF.
Yeah. If we, for example, in rare earth, if we go to dilute its system, doesn't matter. The anisotropy is still there. Whereas here, it really depends where is the nearest neighbor. If there is a case, we have one structure type where we can get, depending on other constituents, nearest neighbors either within the plane or perpendicular to the plane. And experiments show that in this crossover moment, also the anisotropy changes. So the moments just switch over from easy plane to easy axis direction. And doesn't matter really on electrons which other constituents bring, only the distance to nearest uranium neighbor is important.
Is it a principle different from
anisotropy
in cobalt?
No. Actually, this is good point. If we get, for example, cobalt thin layer, in cobalt layers, we have usually moments in the plane, which is probably due to the shape anisotropy. And then if we proceed to one monolayer of cobalt, we get suddenly moments perpendicular. So there is winning the term where we have the electrons are having orbits within the plane because they cannot go out of the plane, and this turns the moments up. So this is analogous, just we have several orders of magnitude higher energies related to that. I will show you, maybe it will be instructive to look at this particular case. Hexagonal, another type of uranium ternaries, there is about 30 or 40 of them. Uranium atoms are organized in the basal plane layers of the hexagonal structure together with part of the transition metal atoms, and then we have some non-transition atoms in layers in between. And typically we have a short interuranium spacing within the plane, about 350 picometers. So this is about the hill limit, and then the distance between the planes is larger, but not terribly large. It's about 400 picometers. But for all of them, we see very striking anisotropic properties. This is one of examples: uranium, nickel, aluminum magnetic susceptibility studied on a single crystal for field along the C-axis. And in basal plane, we actually see something like Pauli paramagnetism. Here we have Curie-Weiss behavior and antiferromagnetic transition. If we have a magnetic field strong enough that we can break this antiferromagnetic coupling and we apply it along the C-axis, we can induce the metamagnetic transition at about 11 Tesla, and we get a field-aligned state in high magnetic fields. Of course, if we apply field along the basal plane, we get nothing. Similar case of antiferromagnetic ground state is uranium, nickel, gallium. There the coupling, the antiferro coupling between the layers is rather weak. In the field less than one Tesla, we can already induce the high field state. And how we can actually estimate the anisotropy energy? It is so large that the estimate is difficult. And one of the ways is to see where these two branches are crossing. If we just extrapolate this to very high fields and keep this constant, we end up at 330 Tesla, which is sort of lower estimate of the anisotropy field. And if we plot inverse susceptibility, and we assume that the susceptibility for field perpendicular to the plane is also Curie-Weiss-like, and we make the fit, we get the difference between particular paramagnetic Curie temperatures, which is about 350 Kelvin. So we get about similar lower estimate of the anisotropy energy here at 350 Kelvin, which is enormous value.
Yes?
Yes.
So is it true that this uranium forms kagamelite, yeah?
Yes.
It's kagame.
This is right, then.
It's ordered, right? I mean, this compound.
It is ordered and.
Two-dimensional.
Yeah. One of characteristic features which I wanted to come to it later is that these strong bonding directions carry usually strong ferromagnetic exchange interactions, which are typically much stronger than would be, for example, corresponding RKKY interactions. And the exchange interactions perpendicular to the strong bonding directions are much weaker, and they can be either ferro or antiferromagnetic. There is no strict rule. So this is the reason why if we have antiferromagnetic ground state and we have ferromagnetic sheets, basal plane sheets, and antiferromagnetic coupling between the sheets, we usually have magnetic fields available to break the antiferromagnetic coupling.
There are always ferromagnetic, yeah? Or there are some things that are not?
There is one case which is nearly ferromagnetic. There is a long modulated structure for uranium, nickel, aluminum, which means Q is very close to zero. For the rest, it is always ferromagnetic. The fact that we have ferromagnetic sheets can be seen very well on electrical resistivity for current along the sheets, which means perpendicular to C. We have something which is strongly resembling ferromagnet. Whereas for current which picks up the antiferromagnetic coupling, we have increase, and then we end up at residual resistivity, which is much, much higher than for this direction. This is also the high residual resistivity is reflecting to the fact that we have a very strong coupling between the direction or even orientation of magnetic moment and the system of conduction electrons, because when we double or multiply the unit cell, we get the magnetic unit cell twice or four times or six times higher than the crystallographic one. We are introducing new brilliant zone boundaries, and if we have the Fermi level which is intersected by the brilliant zone boundaries, we have a gapping of the Fermi surface. And if the interaction, the most simple model which describes it is the Elliott-Wedgwood model, which was introduced for gadolinium in the beginning of 60s, but we can still use it. We have the normal resistivity consisting of residual resistivity, electron phonon scattering, and spin disorder scattering. And in denominator, we have something depending on the sublattice magnetization, which is the basic order parameter in antiferromagnet, and then G, which is called truncation factor. So this is what is reflecting how much the Fermi surface is affected by the new brilliant zone boundaries and also the interaction parameter. So if we have strong interaction, this is a spin-spin exchange interaction. If it is strong, then the gaps at the new brilliant zone boundaries are broader and we are losing more electrons. And the fact that we don't have just dirty crystal, which would lead to high rho zero, is seen here on the upper panel, that if we, the critical field was one Tesla for uranium, nickel, gallium, and if we break this antiferromagnetic coupling and we reduce or we remove this new brilliant zone boundaries, we are reducing residual resistivity from here to here, which is factor of 10. So we have something analogous to giant magnetoresistance. We have a layered system antiferromagnetically coupled, and we apply field. If we get it to ferromagnetic state, we reduce resistivity in enormous way. The last example of anisotropy. We have twins, uranium, rhodium, aluminium is ferromagnet with moment around 1 mu b, and uranium, ruthenium, which is more to the left, stronger hybridized, is just spin fluctuator. And so this is the ferromagnetic one, and for spin fluctuator we have no remanence, no spontaneous moment, but still the susceptibility is higher than for field perpendicular to C. But we see that for this hard magnetization direction, both of them are practically the same. So if we have this ferromagnetic one and we look from wrong direction, we don't see any ferromagnetism at all. It looks like a Pauli paramagnet. We have also cases where moments are non-collinear, and just wanted to mention that there are already LDA-based calculations which can account very well for these different possibilities of orientation of magnetic moment, and they can calculate the anisotropy, and then they usually come to right answer. If we know experimentally from neutron scattering where are the moments, how they are oriented, and so they can really calculate what is the difference in energy between different configurations. This is particularly the result of Sandratsky and Keibler, which are their approach is good to describe non-collinear magnetic structures, and then they can calculate the energy, how it changes when we are counting particular magnetic moments, and they can get density of states projected on individual mu L values. So this is quite reliable. This would be all very nice if we were able systematically to get really to the localized end within, for example, uranium compounds. Uranium is it's good. This is our friend because we can still deal with it quite freely. But all has its limits, and there is very few cases. One of them is uranium palladium 3, where we really can reach the limit of localized 5F states. So we cannot systematically bridge this localization, delocalization transition. We can get to magnetic ordering, we can get to good local moment, we can get to certain exotic states, but it's very hard to get really localized 5F states within uranium compounds. We are trying to search, and the good indicator is, for example, the gamma value. If gamma is below 10, and this is typically value for elemental lanthanides, for example, which have still some 5D states, so gamma is not really low like in copper, but it's not very high. We can assume that the F states are localized, but we have also compounds. Five is the value for the localized UPD3, which has, and everybody accepts that 5F2 configuration localized. But we have compounds where gamma is also 5, it's uranium palladium tin, but it is just due to the low density of states at the Fermi level. And the question is whether the movement of part of the 5F density below the Fermi level and having low gamma is just something like precursor to localization or not. I mean, this is still open question. Of course, you would say that the way to get localization is to have diluted system, to reduce to zero the contribution of 5F-5F overlap to the 5F band formation. But even in that case, it is very difficult. And if we dilute something which has really good local moments, like uranium cobalt tin, this is one of the family, this hexagonal structure which I showed you. In the high dilution limit, we are losing magnetic moment. It goes to zero, and then if we have 10% of uranium, we have again Pauli paramagnet. There are a few exceptions which I think will deserve to be studied more. And one of them is uranium diluted in gold, because there is very weak hybridization with gold. Then some typical diluted systems where somebody reports local moment and constructs quite complicated crystal field theory, which would describe particular specific heat or resistivity. But if it is really the case, if we have localized 5F states, we will have to prove probably by photoelectron spectroscopy, which still can study systems on the level of several percent of uranium in a non-magnetic matrix. And finally, about this general part, I would mention one thing which I should have mentioned before, that we are in most of these systems, except for very weak ferromagnets, which are just at the Hill limit. We are in situation when that we have a two-band situation, that we have F-band and then conduction electron band, and to get this strong interaction, exchange interaction between atoms, we have to assume the hybridization. So we have the hybridization-induced exchange interaction, which is the one which is directional. And typically, if we apply pressure or drive the system by some control parameter to the non-magnetic state, we have reduction of magnetic moment. This is clear. But in some moment, the exchange interaction is growing, and then finally, if we have disappearance of the moment, then it plunges too. So this is quite characteristic for actinides, and we have experimental results which show that as a function of pressure, we get increase of TC and decay, whereas the moments go linearly or monotonously down. So this would be about the very general overview about what is interesting. And now this particular example of uranium cobalt alumina, which is already a member of this group which we know, the structure type which I showed is hexagonal one, which is always uniaxial It is bent metamagnet. What is bent metamagnetism? You know, normal metamagnetism where we have antiferromagnetic ground state, and then as a function of field we can get field-aligned magnetic moments, and there is no phase transition between paramagnetic state and here. So more precisely, we should speak about field-aligned paramagnet as the high field state. Bent metamagnet or itinerant metamagnet is different. We have no phase transition if we go in low fields to low temperatures, and then if we apply field, we get transition to sort of high field state. Typically, the boundary of this phase is increasing with increasing temperature, increasing to higher fields, and from Clausius-Clapeyron equation, we can get some guess about the change of entropy, because the slope, either positive or negative, relates to the entropy across the transition here, where it is first order phase transition. And from that we can deduce that here we are increasing entropy going like that, whereas here we are decreasing entropy. So we can say we are suppressing some spin fluctuations, for example. What can be the reason for such behavior? The first approximation, you can, for example, start thinking of the Stoner model, that we would have splitting of the spin down and spin up subband if the Stoner criterion would be fulfilled. But you can imagine that it's not completely fulfilled. The Stoner product is below 1, let's say 0.95, and we have to apply field to get the splitting. But then there might be some anomaly very close to Fermi level, and suddenly at some field we are already fulfilling the Stoner criterion, and the rest of the process goes spontaneously. So this is how it looks in reality, because you see again the same type of magnetic anisotropy. Magnetization as a function of field, and susceptibility as a function of temperature. There is very pronounced maximum of magnetic susceptibility, reaching a maximum value at about 20 K. And for this compound, the critical field is below 1 Tesla, which is very, very low field and makes it easy to study. There are more compounds of this itinerant metamagnetic type. All of them are based on cobalt, actually. There is yttrium cobalt 2, for example, which has the critical metamagnetic field 70 Tesla. This is very difficult to reach. Here we have something which behaves phenomenologically very similar, but the critical field is much lower.
Is this transition first order?
This transition is first order, and the details can be seen here. There is even weak hysteresis, which is weak but real. And you see how it moves towards higher fields when we increase the temperature, which is what is expected by the theories, which include spin fluctuations. There should be quadratic increase with temperature. The moments 0.3 Bohr magneton are, in this case, result of partial compensation of orbital moment 0.6 and spin moment about 0.3 antiparallel. This is in the field of 1 Tesla, and if we go to 8 Tesla, you saw that the high field susceptibility is appreciable. So one would hope that we get something else, that we perhaps increase the spin component more or increase the orbital component, but this is not the case. The ratio of spin and orbital moment is all the time about 2, so this does not give us more hints why this mu L over mu S, or in which situation it can change. The fact that the critical field is really depending on T square, you can see very well, not only for pure uranium, cobalt, aluminum, but also for some substituted materials with nickel, which have the critical field higher. Substitution is the way if experimentalist wants to study stability of something, if he wants to change something, so he does the substitution. But first, let's see what is the, for example, electrical resistivity for the two directions. We see spin fluctuation type. There is indeed no phase transition seen. Nothing really spectacular except for the values which are naturally large, and they are higher for the current along the A-axis, where we have this strongly correlated two-dimensional systems.
What is magnetic resistance?
I will show immediately. There is step down in the gamma coefficient of the specific heat, and magnetic resistance is not really large for low temperatures where we don't include spin fluctuations and we have just step. This is for current along A. For higher temperatures, we are changing the spectrum of spin fluctuations. We see how the critical field is increasing with increasing temperature, and then this decay down is due to the Zeeman energy, which should suppress all spin fluctuations. For current along C, we have opposite step. But because we have higher multiplicity of the current along A, so the resistivity, the total resistivity or average resistivity is decreasing. We have, for the rest of the picture is similar. Substitutions. Yeah? I said that we try doping, and to our surprise, already 1% of iron or ruthenium is stabilizing the high field state down to zero field. Whereas if we go to nickel or platinum, we are moving the critical field to the right to higher values, which is a little bit contradicting to the fact which I was stressing before, that we get magnetic ordering for transition metals from the very last end, right end of the periodic table. And indeed, there we have magnetic ordering of antiferromagnetic type for uranium, nickel, aluminum, and ferro for uranium, platinum, aluminum. But then we have non-magnetic range, and then for cobalt, this line represents always uranium, cobalt, aluminum, and then we put a little bit iron or a little bit ruthenium, we stabilize something like island of ferromagnetism, which has very small magnetic moment. It's typically very weak itinerant ferromagnetism, and the metamagnetic behavior is just at the edge. This is the hatched region at the edge of this anomalous ferromagnetism.
And so you have quantum critical points if this is done at your temperature?
We will see quantum critical points.
Do you have a density of states of this UCOAL calculation?
There were done plenty of them, starting Ole Eriksson 1989, and indeed they got something very close to 1 as to the Stoner product. So they predicted metamagnetism in ground state. The Stoner product is slightly below 1, and then they had some higher state, but they could not get really the critical field. It was the forced moment method. There is still mainly the 5F magnetism. So the density of states is at the ascending edge of the 5F band, but then there is a gap towards the D states, cobalt D states. What is highly anomalous is a dilution of the uranium sublattice. Normally, if you start dilute system with just local moments, you get to very high dilution limits, and then you get something like spin glass disordered state, and eventually magnetism disappears completely. Here, if we put 10% of yttrium inside, which goes on the uranium sides, we get very weak ferromagnetism, and then it again disappears very fast, and then for 30% lithium we get already non-magnetic behavior. Appearance of ferromagnetism could be understood as due to increasing of mean uranium separation a little bit, so we are still getting a little bit narrower 5F band, and we get for this very limited concentration range long-range ferromagnetic order.
So what is the phase diagram of this alloy? You have the phase diagram?
You mean...
In XT, for example?
The phase diagram, the ground state is paramagnetic. There are no other phases except for the phase which is induced by magnetic field. You can see what we can do by magnetic field. This is the susceptibility for field along C. This is the maximum which you saw before, now in different scale. And if we apply field in the low temperature range, we induce the high field state. And because the critical field is increasing with increasing temperature, then we need more and more field to keep this high field state towards higher temperatures.
Magnetic field X plane. Yeah, but here, if it's first order, then I don't know
if we
speak about quantity.
If we are here. This is the first order phase transition up to about 7K, and then we get broadening, and it has just character of some crossover. There is no.
Right, but now you have a new axis, which is X, coming out of the plane, right?
Yeah.
And
so for.
Ask how that thing
so then.
The function of X.
So for 1% of iron, we are already pushing this area down, and still it is depending on temperature, and then you will see on pressure that in fact we can all tune by external pressure, normally hydrostatic pressure. Yeah. This is our tool. Huh? Two slightly different concentrations, which shift the critical field, and then we apply hydrostatic pressure, which is compressing actually mainly along A, because this is very soft direction, and we are shifting the critical field up. And if we have the one with 1% iron, which starts already here, we get also metamagnetism under pressure. Should have it somewhere. With yttrium, it becomes first more and then plunges down.
It never becomes ferromagnetic.
It becomes ferromagnetic. Yes. So this is the one with 2% iron, and the transition is not so well pronounced because this is polycrystal now, and so you have to get the real magnetic moments, you have to multiply it by two, because this is normal in uniaxial case. So this also documents that for the metamagnetic state, the high field state, we have something which is qualitatively very similar already to normal ferromagnetic state, which is the one here, that the high field metamagnetic state doesn't have any special attributes. The quantum critical point, you all know what it is. We are on non-magnetic side in the ground state of uranium, cobalt, aluminum, let's say here, and we don't see, we actually see, as I will show you this, we see non-Fermi liquid behavior of the resistivity very well pronounced in all the low field states, even for the substituted or doped compound, and we actually don't see this Fermi liquid situation. Even if we go to rather low temperatures, we still plan to go to millikelvin range to see if the behavior of resistivity characterized as 5/3 exponent, which is very robust, surprisingly. We see this in all the low field states. And if we get to the high field state, we see the Fermi liquid behavior, because you see normal Fermi liquid behavior also here, because you have the residual light electrons, which have also the Fermi liquid behavior.
What exponent do you see in this NFL region?
So here we see 5/3, and these are the fits here. So this is the 5/3 fit. You can't get really feeling about how this is necessary to go to 5/3, but if we apply a quadratic fit, which is this one used, then we are hopeless. I mean, there is very, very strong difference. So there is no doubt that we have 5/3 behavior, which is what theories assume for nearly ferromagnetic materials.
Now the magnetic field goes back to T square?
With magnetic field, immediately above the transition, it goes to T square, and the A coefficient of this quadratic dependence goes then gradually, slowly down if we increase the field.
That one seems to be entirely similar to this Strohm-Rutenay that McKenzie studied, that was famous work, and they had linear behavior. I don't remember how it was.
It depends on dimensionality and type of coupling. You have for three-dimensional antiferromagnet, you have 3/2, and if you go to two-dimensional antiferromagnet, you have T/1. For three-dimensional ferromagnets, we have 3/5 as the standard expression, which first it was calculated by Mathon, 1968. It's mentioned actually here. This is the first report on this typical exponent. At that time, people didn't call it non-Fermi liquid behavior, but it's already dealt with for several decades. So what? Another transparency of this type. So we are here. We don't see this, which is strange. We can get to here, but we have the first order transition, so we don't see again a gradual crossover, which is disappointing. And so this is why we started to apply pressure, because pressure can expand this region and can suppress this region if we assume that these arrows stay in the same position. But let's assume if we something
is just the opposite. If you apply pressure, then things become less magnetic, so this whole construction should
okay. So we keep the colors, and we move the arrows. I mean, in this way, yeah? you can assume both, yeah. And I showed you already one pressure dependence. The other one, how we monitor what is going on with pressure, is to study magnetostriction as a function of field, which means expansion along A-axis, and then transition leads to contraction along the C-axis, and then we put it to the pressure cell. So we see how all this is moving very fast to higher fields if we apply hydrostatic pressure. And we see also that the step is gradually reduced, and for itinerant magnets, actually the change of the volume due to magnetic ordering is proportional to the square of the magnetic moment. This is since Peter Wohlfarth theory's beginning of 60s, and Here we don't play with volume and spontaneous moment. We play with the increment of the moment at the transition. And we found that this scaling does not work with volume, but what is really scaling as the square is the real compression along A and the increase along A. So the A is really the critical direction. So originally the expressions were derived for isotropic materials. So we can use these expressions to try to see where the metamagnetism should be suppressed, that we would get really the arrows out of the magnetic area. But the pressure is too high so far to reach this point. We would need at least 70 or 80 kilobar, which is too high for us. And but we are of course extending the non-magnetic state, which is the one which is interesting, and we can follow what is going on with pressure, for example, with the coefficient B for the resistivity, the prefactor for the T2 5/3, and we see that it is decreasing what we expect, but not really much, and we can't still see this underlying Fermi liquid range. So the conclusion is that we have something which is very robust, and it makes impression that we are dealing not with proximity to the quantum critical point, but Yeah, but
summarize which regions of the phase diagram you studied. I mean, it's not clear to me.
Now we are this which I showed. We are here.
What's the control parameter?
Pressure.
Okay. So
we are playing with pressure and temperature. And
so which pressure. Region have you scanned?
Pressure should move. If we assume that the color map stays, the pressure should move this arrow to the right, and we expected to see this Fermi liquid, and we don't see it. We just reduce the B here, but we still don't see the Fermi liquid.
Are you in a magnetic state or in a non-magnetic?
Non-magnetic state.
So you're in you have a non-magnetic state which exists for a wide range of pressures, and you claim that there is no Fermi liquid behavior in this wide range of pressures.
And it keeps
getting closer to Fermi liquid with pressure,
but very very slowly, yeah. and we would like okay, it goes from 9 to 6 in rather low pressures, but we would like at least
compression for this pressure, maybe it's a fraction of percent.
It is of course it is.
You're far from if you're a critical point, any small pressure should drive you away.
But I mean, this is real time pressure. This is nearly negligible pressure, and they already changed the coefficient by a factor of 2. So they just—it looks like if you applied any decent pressure, I don't know, 30, 40 kilobars, which is still very small pressure, you will already cross this line.
Okay, I would take it if we start to see below at lower temperatures this green phase,
right.
The Fermi liquid phase. But this is not the case.
Down to which temperatures?
Down to 1.5.
The resistivity is a function of pressure and temperature.
Actually, the real details of resistivity we have here, which was to about 1.5. But this is without pressure. But the character remains absolutely the same. I mean, the quality of fit remains the same down to 1.5. And of course, we can think to go further on.
What happens at high temperatures?
We have already this crossover to this spin fluctuation knee, which means gradual saturation of resistivity. So here we have about one decade at least, or one and a half decades. So what I want to say is that it makes the impression that really we are not like close to the quantum critical point, but we are hitting something which is a phase, which doesn't have the point here, but it has some phase of stability, and it is distinguished by the first order phase transition from some magnetic phase, and we don't see this phase at all.
And the specific heat?
The specific heat is done, of course, not in pressure, and there is suppression of gamma from 80 to 60 across the transition. No. There is upturn, but it was studied by Japanese down to millikelvin, but they were not really sure about the scaling or the thermometry. I mean the calibration of thermometer, so they did not really try to do the fit to the logarithmic scaling, but clearly it could be described by that, and we did not do this experiment.
Because it's a curved line at critical point, right? So the gamma should be logarithmic in three dimensions. Is that observed?
Clearly, you should be able to fit the data to logarithmic dependence. The question if it is really logarithmic or not, I would just leave open. I mean, this is not enough persuading. Just the fact that you can fit it, you know.
And how about the susceptibility in that region?
Susceptibility, it has the maximum and then it goes down. I showed you this detailed feature, and this is something which is very much different from all normal non-Fermi liquid theories, because we have all the normal non-Fermi liquid theories assume susceptibility just going up. To certain moment, but this is theories which don't describe the band metamagnetism. This is unusual combination of this band metamagnetism and the non-Fermi liquid behavior, which makes it really exotic. And this is, as far as I know, the only case.
Okay. Therefore, all this hype last year about this story, which is exactly the same system except two dimensional.
Okay, I should relate it.
And probably dimensionality may be very important, but it's really close to what you're telling, even in the very detail. They also have, instead of one point, a finite region of non-Fermi behavior in zero temperature. And essentially interpret that as a quantum physical point at negative temperature, which can never be really reached.
So as to theories, the standard theory is the one of Yamada, which is a sort of extension of Moria spin fluctuation theory, which is assuming that we have three terms of free energy up to the sixth order term, whereas normally for weak ferromagnets you can work with the two terms and they give linear arrowed plots and so on. And this also, okay, you have then this type of free energy, and if you apply magnetic field you are pulling this minimum down, and then at certain field it starts to be stable and you have the first order phase transition. And this theory also predicts why there should be the maximum of magnetic susceptibility. It depends on the mean square amplitude of spin fluctuations, and the parameter B is something describing the mode-mode coupling. So you should have negative B and a large negative B to have this type of free energy and susceptibility with maximum. So Yamada even recently extended, just because of uranium, cobalt, aluminum, this theory to uniaxial case, because all was done for a isotropic systems like yttrium, cobalt, II. But there is also another theory, Takahashi and Sakai, which really assume that there are two different states, both without the sixth order term, which explains why the high field state is in fact something like normal ferromagnetic state, because you saw that there is just continuation between these two states, that the high field state is not really something exotic which would need a sixth order term. And there are spin fluctuations in both of them, so I sort of prefer this approach, but none of them really tells anything about the transport coefficients and so on. So there should be still something to do as to resistivity and to explain the non-Fermi liquid behavior in such systems. The theory is not yet that far.
So you're saying the important thing is that there is a metamagnetic critical point nearby. How is this different from? Why do you think this is different from the standard ferromagnetic to paramagnetic transition?
I don't know. Probably underlying reason is this proximity to the Stoner criterion, which makes it then to split in certain field. But you have strong spin fluctuations already in the ground state. Then you apply the high field state and you change it. But maybe it is just the nature of the low spin state which is anomalous, and the fact that you are removing it is not already important for it. I don't know, but the susceptibility with the broad maximum is typical, yeah? So there must be something different.
One difference is symmetry consideration, and it might be, if I can draw this vertex, this is a conventional quantum critical point, it's something like this, right? Whereas this is pressure, this is Curie temperature, this is quantum critical point,
yeah.
Right? Now, it's metamagnetism, forget about critical points first. What is metamagnetism? Metamagnetism is in principle, first order transition. So it ends a normal critical point somewhere here.
Yeah.
Right? Now, by doing some external, let's say you change concentration, right, then you just drive this thing here.
Yeah.
But it becomes critical point. Essentially, and that was probably what they see, and what these British people claim to see, is that when they actually drive it right here. So the symmetry here and here is the same, and when you go like this, it's just crossover, which is different from the quantum critical point. And that may
so the goal would be, I mean, what should be done experimentally is, for example, to get pressure high enough to get to the bottom here, huh? For which we need 60-70 kilobar.
I mean, this color change is presumably not a phase transition. It's a smooth crossover.
Is that true?
Yeah. For higher temperatures, we have real crossover.
And for lower temperatures, there
isn't. Here we have the first order phase transition somewhere low.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I see. Right.
Yeah.
Right. I see. So it's quite interesting. So you should draw this a little bit better, right? You should indicate that there is a line that ends in the second order point. And
Yeah.
You try the same model that Mackenzie showed last year at the APS meeting, where they actually did a kind of continuous fit of this exponent in resistivity,
mm-hmm,
and colors that, like, from yellow to red and so on. That was a color map which was gradually changing all over.
Yeah, yeah. But here we have real step. There is.
The power remains exactly the same.
We have nothing.
That's the way how they fitted it. I don't think they tried, did you? Like Mackenzie tried to do, which probably less reliable but more interesting in some sense. They were taking little parts, and no, they was temperature dependent coefficient. And you did a standard job by taking large temperature interval and fitting it. Right?
No, I tried all. I mean, how it was in reality, I took this part of resistivity which makes sense to be fitted, and I released the exponent and I got 1.67. So then I took half of that and I got still 1.67. So then I started to think what means 1.67.
But what's confusing is the finite temperature part of the phase diagram, and experimentally should be able to distinguish what's a crossover from a phase transition at finite temperatures. I mean, the specific heat has a clear singularity. I mean, the susceptibility has a clear singularity. So that's what's confusing.
You can't measure very well specific heat as a function of field, but susceptibility. Yeah. So there should be something like line, and then there should be, let's say, broken line.
It's over, yeah. And then it becomes more clear what's going on.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the theoretical problem that you're raising remains, but at least we can try to formulate that.
But is it really true, for instance, that suppose I consider, say, HT plane with this a first order magnetic transition, which in principle should end at some critical point.
Yes.
What becomes of this critical point, say, under pressure? Does it go down?
I just told.
No, I know. What you usually mean, I'm asking what's going on in reality in this particular thing. Well, I don't know. Does it go to H equals 0 or T equals 0 or whatever, or not?
This we don't know, although it is very easy to distinguish this critical point. If we do AC susceptibility, then in this critical point we get very sharp peak and then nothing. And if we go from this regime, we suddenly get something broad.
For other magnetics, more conventional, I don't know, Cobalt 2, for other magnetic, people did observe that this conventional critical point is first order, one goes to zero temperature.
What's on the experimental side?
Okay, we should do something more. Thank you. So you want still to hear something about plutonium?
I want to hear. But people are free to leave.
If Gab is going to listen to plutonium, or? I'm going to listen to it as well. Because I want to watch his face when you say it.
Okay, so briefly. Yeah. So I said that to get real crossover to localized states was sort of frustrating for uranium compounds, and the way is to proceed to plutonium, where we can get these numerous phases, and we are already very close to plutonium americium localization transition. So here we have the delta phase and low volume alpha phase. The high volume is FCC, but surprisingly, this is the most complicated one because that's probably the only element where LDA standard calculations are failing completely to describe the proper volume calculation in delta. And if one allows for magnetic ordering, the calculations would like to have it magnetically ordered, whereas we know that this is non-magnetic. So there was the dispute. The volume of the alpha phase can be reproduced, but if it is structure two, yeah. What we do experimentally is photoelectron spectroscopy, where we can see the details of electron states in the valence band, and then we do 4F core level spectroscopy. And these are all data of Mengele from 80s, where we can see, if we proceed from thorium up, that we are gradually filling the 5F band, and we see nothing spectacular. We just get a higher density of states at the Fermi level. We get more occupied 5F states, but the 5F band is gradually reduced, the width. So in fact, what we see is about the same width. And then we get a qualitative step to americium. We get low density of states at the Fermi level, and we see final state multiplet, presumably 5F6 to 5F5. At least it was interpreted like that. So we have, again, enormous step between these two limits. That was alpha plutonium, but for delta plutonium we already get something completely different. We see a satellite maximum at about 0.8 eV. The feature at the Fermi level is much narrower, and the question if it is really at the Fermi level, I will show to that some details, and there is some intermediate peak at half eV below. Comparison with alpha plutonium shows that we have very, very different situation. And in fact, for uranium, we don't see qualitative difference for all of other cases. Large variety of magnetism, this is ferromagnetism, this is antiferromagnetism, and we see still this more or less featureless 5F states. Underlying is the calculated density of states. This was done by the Dresden people, Peter Opener, Manuel Richter. So we don't get real surprise, real qualitative difference in most of uranium compounds. But plutonium is different, and we studied so far several plutonium compounds. Sort of reference point is plutonium antimony, which is known that this is localized 5F5, so this is really good reference, and indeed the Fermi level is here, low density of states, and the main 5F response is at about 2 eV. What is the only surprise is that we don't see any resolved lines of the multiplet. Is that beeping? Should we leave? Is it alarm or contamination alarm? Again, americium, which you saw before, showing these features below the Fermi level. And now some intermediate case. First, I would say that we can distinguish very well by experimental technique which states are 5F. They increase very much the intensity if we go from 21 eV excitation radiation to 40 eV, because the photoexcitation cross-section of the 5F states is increased very much. So what is increased belongs to 5F states. So we see, in fact, four different peaks belonging to 5F states. And if we play a little bit with the system, we see that, in fact, there are two groups. These three guys within 1 eV below the Fermi level go somehow up and down together, and they go against this one. We attribute this one to the real localized 5F states, whereas we are not sure about these three features. They seem to be somehow related to the itinerant character of the compounds. Why? Because we also see in the 4F lines what is going on. And 4F lines are deep in the core. They are more than 400 eV below the Fermi energy. But if we make a 4F hole, we can see how the system reacts by screening. So if the system has itinerant 5F states, it is energetically favorable if there is this reconfiguration of the 5F electrons, which can screen the 4F hole. They can get close to the 4F hole because the 5F states are deep in the core. So we end up at some final energy which is lower than the other case, where we have screening by non-F states, which means if we have localized 5F states, they cannot screen, they cannot reorganize in a way effectively to screen the hole. So the screening goes via SP6D states of the valence band. So then the final energy is higher and the kinetic energy of photoelectrons is lower. So we see for this plutonium antimony case only the poor screening of 4F5½, 4F7½ peaks. Alpha plutonium, we have dominant well screening. So this shows that this is still well itinerant case. The poorly screened peaks here and here are just carrying minority of the spectral intensity. Then we have plutonium selenium, which is non-magnetic sort of semiconducting material, where we can assume in first approximation that we are somewhere between 5F5, 5F6. And we see dominant poorly screened peaks, but still small but very noticeable well screened peaks. And
so basically, can you explain a little bit better? I mean, this is just the standard X-ray shape line, no? Where you have a core hole and you take one core hole.
Yeah.
So from there, how do you infer this? How something about the screening?
That's the position of the line, which tells us about the final energy of the screened hole. The hole is not reoccupied on the short time scale of the photoemission event, so you just see the very fast response of the system. So if you get screening by the 5Fs, then you get lower final energy, so you see higher kinetic energy, so you see positions which have offset by 2-3 eV from this position up. So this is this. Huh? And the shape, there's the Doniach-Sundzic line shape, which shows that there are electron hole pairs of low energy, but there are plenty of them excited around the Fermi level, so we have high density of states around the Fermi level. Whereas if we don't have this, we have peaks which actually contain all the manifold of different orientations of the final multiplet 4f and localized multiplet 5f, so that there can be many, many peaks and we can't resolve it. But therefore the 4f 5 half have different widths than 4f 7 half, and here they are approximated by the Voigt line shape, but there is no physical reason why it should be like that. This is just a description to account for the total intensity to fit it somehow. But the shape can be somehow strange, you know, because there are many, many lines of this manifold included. So now we have just a game. What is this intensity comparing to this intensity? If we have if we push it to more itinerant state, we should increase this and suppress this. It is the probability of the screening essentially. It probably doesn't tell that here we have 90% localization and 10% itinerant character, but there should be roughly monotonous correspondence to localization, delocalization. You mean here?
No, low. Yeah.
This one, I mean...
No,
All this. It could be roughly attributed to the 5F6 multiplet, not to 5F5. Okay. If we rescale it from what is known from Samarium, for example, where it has larger spread, right. But we could somehow rape it to to get it as a multiplet. But then the position just at the Fermi level would be purely coincidental. There is no reason why the multiplet should be just at the Fermi level. It would be a surprise. Okay, what we did more to see if we can get localization of plutonium if we reduce the thickness in thin layers. And after a while, we succeeded to prepare layers with very little interaction with the substrate on magnesium. And this is about the situation nearly delta plutonium. And if we reduce the thickness, we are again suddenly having appeared the feature around 2 eV, which is presumably the localized feature. And then in intermediate thickness, we have appearance of 1, 2, 3 these peaks exactly at the same energy as you saw for plutonium selenium. Then for one monolayer, we have residual 3 features, and the main spectral intensity is in the localized state. So this would show that we have localization when we approach one monolayer, which is quite unique. There are localization processes. If you go to the situation below two-dimensional, if you have small clusters, you can, of course, localize states even in alkali metals. But I have not seen any case of localization below the 2D limit is achieved. The 4F core level lines are just corresponding to that. We have, as I said, we have suppression of well-screened peaks here, and poorly screened peaks are growing, and we have some small remaining spectral intensity on the well-screened positions, which can mean also that our layer is not really homogeneous. We don't have really homogeneous coverage. There are places which are completely without plutonium, and then perhaps we have islands which are 2, maybe 3 plutonium atoms on the top of each other. We spoke with Gabi about if there is just purely F character at the Fermi level peak, and this is now changing between thicker and thinner layer. For one monolayer, means nearly localized case, we see that all the 5F features are suppressed about in the same way. Whereas for two monolayers and higher, we have the Fermi level feature which is remaining there quite substantially. If we have if the red ones are 421 eV, so we should not see 5F states here, which means that this feature at the Fermi level contains appreciable amount of non-F states. For this case, not for plutonium, selenium, there it is suppressed completely similar to this case. So the conclusion is that that there is something variable, mainly in the Fermi level feature. Okay, we did a couple of other things. Delta plutonium stabilized by americium, where nothing is really going on. Okay, better let's look here on the core levels. This is actually strange because if we dope americium into delta plutonium, we keep the structure up to 60% americium. We keep the delta plutonium structure and we strongly expand the volume. And since the 80s, people assume that this could drive the system more towards localization in plutonium. The americium states are localized all the time. They are not in the game, but just the size factor should produce the localization. And here we see that it is not the case. Up to 30% americium, we see still the same line shape of the core levels as in pure delta plutonium, or very weakly doped delta plutonium. And only after that, if we cross 30%, we get this situation that we have the shoulder more pronounced.
But you don't expect in the core levels to have a big change. It's in the valence levels.
In the valence band is more involved, because there you see plutonium and americium states over each other. Here in the core levels they are shifted, for americium is far away, but here you can see americium states are deeper, so what you see close to the Fermi level is mainly plutonium, and you see something very typical for delta plutonium as well, and only for high americium concentrations you get the suppression of the Fermi level region. You see that here it is emphasized a bit there. At the Berkeley meeting there was report by Jean-Marc Fournier about the susceptibility, and they also observed nothing up to 30%, and then there was some variation.
Right, but look at this. This is a very nice curve, because it really shows that as you alloy with americium, you increase the correlations, and then basically you split further the Haber bands, and you make the resonance more sharp. So that's precisely what dynamic mean field theory predicts.
Oh, yeah. Although, I mean, here you have increase of americium content, so you can't say that you support the lower Hubbard subband, but clearly you make the resonance sharper. This is true. Right. And
GMFT results.
We haven't had any calculations for that, but that's what we would expect.
Do you get a magnetic ground state or not?
Do we get a what?
Magnetic ground
state. No.
It is definitely non magnetic.
It's definitely non magnetic because it's a Gondo energy which is quenching the spin. In principle, one could try to find in some other regime magnetic solutions. I'm sure that one can find also magnetic solutions with EMFT, but you would have to decrease the hybridization a lot. We checked within IPT, but one could check more. But in this parameter regime, with the hybridization is so large, you don't expect magnetism.
Did you try to get a magnetic solution?
No,
yes, we
tried. Okay. We tried in a limited way. I mean, I'm saying one can explore more if you think that's a good
question. I mean, when I do a parametric calculation, I don't put in a solution. Whenever I allow for spin polarization in a normal, it always goes.
So if you just start from LTA magnetic solution, does it converge to a paramagnetic like you did with the aluminum?
I know that we put self-energies, which are magnetic, then it converts to non-magnetic self-energy. But what should do a full calculation where you also, that can be checked more. I mean, there's more to be done. But the indications that we have is that it's not magnetic.
And you think it's condor, which is...
Yes.
So the last case I want to show you is the nitride. We can do sputtering.
Also, hybridization. We don't need to call it condor because the hybridization is large. Condor usually refers to the situation when the hybridization is very small. When the hybridization is large, it's more like mixed valence.
Interesting case of nitrogen.
Yeah, but they have too much hybridization.
That would drive it just more non-magnetic. So it's not fully understandable.
Yeah.
So if anything, I would expect that them to be losing error in both directions.
Yeah. Well, also the temperature, really, right? Just a second. Our calculations were done at 600 degrees, and LDA calculations are done at zero temperature. So.
This makes a difference.
This can make a difference.
Well,
that's a good question.
The question would be, if it's just a difference in thermal function distribution, that's nothing. Forget about that. But you obviously have thermal fluctuation when you do this, right? I would say that the real difference is not hybridization, but that you guys have fluctuations inside and they don't, and fluctuations destroy magnetism, similar to what Sasha had for aluminum, which is totally different story.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Just this last case, PUN, we can change the concentration of nitrogen up to 1:1 concentration, just varying the pressure. And we see still that the Fermi level characteristics remain about the same. PUN is actually not very far from plutonium metal. It is clearly itineran system. Plutonium atoms are close together, but we still expected at least some change. But we are just seeing that the nitrogen 2p states are increasing, whereas here we have the same character. But if we enlarge, it's not completely the same. There are changes on a small scale. If we enlarge this range close to the Fermi level, we see that something which was practically at the Fermi level within the experimental energy resolution is moving below with increasing contents. And then we did, using the new high power UV source, we did a new experiment with very high energy resolution. And you see the gold Fermi edge, so you see what is about the experimental resolution, and you see that the black line has really the maximum practically at the Fermi level, whereas for increasing nitrogen contents, we don't have just shift of this to lower energy, but we have increasing some spectral intensity here below, which is peaking at about 140 MeV. There was a dispute about the position of this Fermi level feature, or close to Fermi level feature, between alpha delta plutonium. Alpha plutonium also shows something which is broader and apparently more below the Fermi energy. If it is the case, it would mean that there are like two different features which can be close, and we are just changing the weight of them. This is plutonium which starts from alpha, but if we sputter this one, the black one, if we sputter, then we get so many defects that the spectra look more like delta. So it's practically corresponding to delta, and even we found, I didn't show the results there. If we have alpha plutonium and we allow the surface to relax by increasing temperature, we get the delta plutonium surface. So this is delta, and here we get something which would probably correspond to alpha, because we also saw that alpha has this feature shifted, but we didn't study it with such high resolution.
This difference you got, I mean, can you really read anything? I mean, couldn't it just be... Oh, wait a minute. Are you getting just the F character there, or is this...
Practically F character. This is helium-2.
That's different.
There can be slight admixture of something, but about constant. Doesn't change here. This is the same excitation energy.
And the structure of plutonium nitride is the same as delta plutonium?
No, this is cubic. Sodium chloride.
Okay.
So now one of the...
Sodium is FCC in NaCl.
Yeah.
Sodium is the same structure because...
Yeah, that's...
But volume of FCC?
The volume is very small, isn't it?
Okay, here we have nitrogen atom, so it's somewhere around the Hill limit. So, but delta PU is below the Hill limit for plutonium. So they can be like 10-15% different, I think. Now the crucial point: what is the origin of these three features? If it is really the final state multiplet 5F6, or then it would mean that plutonium is the mixed valent between 5F5 and 5F6, and the lower feature, which is unresolved, would be just 5F5 to 5F4. Huh?
Yeah, but
this would be analogy to samarium.
But that's just a description of the Haber band.
Right. Yeah.
This is just an experimentalist way of saying this is that you have a Haber band and you have some quasi-particle features near the Fermi level. The thing which is surprising is that you can see multiplets in the extended states. That's surprising, right, Sasha?
Yeah,
but you're saying in samarium,
for certain frames,
for samarium there is multiplet, and there is a new photoemission data on samarium sulfide, which I read just on the plane here. That they did something with very high resolution and also angle resolved, and they attributed it classically to the 5F6 to 5F5 multiplet. Although the first peak is a little bit far below the Fermi level, so it's not at the Fermi level. But what was shocking was that they found a dispersion in these features. So it's like a multiplet hybridized with conduction electrons and having dispersion, and I took this paper with me. You want?
So we should try to do samarium sulfide with the MFT.
You can have a look here. This is very nice work.
This is probably much better than argument of plutonium. We should really do this.
Yeah.
Samarium sulfide.
Yeah.
What do you think, Sasha?
We did.
I think that would be a lot more convincing.
There is some. Somehow in the last few days something about which was PUSE that came up in this talk, but also in this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
PUSE is very similar to samarium sulfide. Plutonium selenide.
Yes.
And telluride as well.
Very similar. And there's a guy, Bachter, playing yes. That's the same physics. Which of course he sees mixed metals and everything, but
right.
So,
thanks, speaker.
Thank you for your large patience.